Good afternoon. Welcome to the final session for today on this side of the fence. Chris Miller is going to give a presentation entitled Burma on Record Before 1962, a Discography in Context. And a couple of words about Chris Miller. He is curator of the eKinetics and Cross-Cultural Dance Resources Collection in the School of Dance at Arizona State University. He is a trustee of the Burma Study Foundation, and his research in Burma, now spanning a decade, has been supported by the Blake Moore Foundation, the Center for Burma Studies at Northern Illinois University, and the U.S. Department of State. I give you Chris Miller. Got all that right, right?
Thank you, Michael. All right. I'm hoping not to electrocute myself this morning. All right. Sorry for that. It's been 4 years now since I last reported to this association on the present-day state of recorded popular music in the Union of Myanmar, or for greater ease of identification today, I'll use colloquial Burma. And I'm pleased to say that the ongoing creation, performance, and production of pop, rock, hip-hop, metal, country, and every genre in between not only maintains in urban centers, but in the periphery as well. And though progress has been slow, and likely will be into the foreseeable future, it is promising enough to see that recorded sound production continues to emerge from the restraints and poverty of the close to four decades following the military takeover of government in 1962. Which is nonetheless ongoing and establishes a benchmark for my presentation today, though as a point of conclusion. And I have to thank my commenters from 4 years ago for, in some part, sending me down this trail. I'll refer to one recent event as the nexus of the project as well, and that would be the landfall of Cyclone Nargis in May of 2008. Let's see if I can mouse. All right. And it is, in some ways, a sad parallel to be presenting here in New Orleans, because we're talking about, in many ways, a similar situation. Nargis, on 2008, May 2nd and 3rd, landfall was basically just to the east of Rangoon, and in its wake left about 150,000 people dead, 2.5 million homeless, and devastated most of the livestock and rice holdings that supplied much of the country. And I need not expound on the dangers to archives of such a storm in this audience. But the challenge is intrinsic to Burma, further exasperated by its recent past, only increased cause for concern. And I'll add a couple of anecdotes here relating to Nargis. It's difficult in Myanmar to get any kind of reliable information because of the secrecy of the government and how prevalent its presence is, especially in Rangoon. And so the rumors were that Myanmar Athan, which is, of course, holds most of the Burma Broadcasting Service tapes and audio, was either completely devastated by the cyclone and left exposed to it, or was moved to Naypyidaw, up in the center of the country, where it's now completely isolated. And I haven't been able to confirm either. But it's safe to say at least that it's an inaccessible collection. So having grown concerned over the state or even existence of archives of recorded sound within Burma, I began to reach out to contacts in and out of the country. And the result was an application to the Ambassador's Fund for Cultural Preservation administered by the State Department, authored by myself and two colleagues, I'd like to acknowledge Kit Young, and my co-author today, Namyo Aung. I should stress here at the beginning that the goal of the project was that it should serve as a pilot project on two fronts. The first was the identification of privately held collections of 78 RPM records and the digitization of a sample. And the second was the recording of oral histories among aging musicians, some of whom are pictured there, in both Yangon and Mandalay. as a stopgap effort against the loss of intangible cultural heritage. Now, AFCP funding is insufficient to accomplish sustained and comprehensive work on either side of this dual project. Rather, it was meant to get the ball rolling and to establish an initial effort in support of applications for larger funding. And of course, the discographic work that I'm presenting to you today was a natural outgrowth of the work that we did on the project. And to, just to give you, as interested an audience here, the funding for the project is such that a very minimal studio setup was sent over to Yangon through diplomatic pouch. It made it possible to capture recordings at 2496, but I have to admit, between electricity issues, there are frequent brownouts even in Yangon, and with the challenges inherent in training the local staff working into them a culture of adhering to some of the standards, at times the project has been difficult to maintain and to manage, not to mention the fact that just traveling to Myanmar in general, doing something like this outside of government awareness and to a certain regard spying on what you're doing is difficult to do as well, and suspicion. With regard to the records themselves, we started the project with the knowledge that we would be seeing a lot of Columbia Graphophone and then Gramophone Company's recordings. What we didn't know, didn't expect, was to see a lot of locally produced recordings as well, which I'll get to soon, which was a pleasant surprise. So going back and providing a little historical context for a moment. For the past century, the center of cosmopolitan life in Burma has been Rangoon, there in the south at the Delta. But the recognized center for Burmese culture had been located further north, and essentially around Mandalay, up in the center of the country, in what the British identified as Upper Burma, and was the center of the Kambong courts, and therefore musical culture. And that area lost three successive conflicts with the British that pushed further and further north, and finally led to the complete annexation of Upper Burma in 1886. And at this point, Burma is more or less invented as a country and administered through a system of diarchy, mostly maintained through India. So not directly administered, actually from England. And the Rangoon of 1872, though previously administered by the courts, was an important maritime center and intersection point with European trade, but was mostly a small and sleepy port city. And at the time of 1872, during a census, about two-thirds of the tiny population was Burmese. And that's contrasted with a census from 1937 of Rangoon, in which only a little more than a quarter of the population of 400,000 residents were Burmese. I note these differences here to establish some context for the recording industry that grew up in Rangoon, where a notable shift in population saw the arrival of immigrants from Europe, southern China, and southern India, pressed on mostly by trade. But then also to note an important point on musical culture shifting from the courts, the Kambong courts up north, down to the city of Rangoon. This is a quote that some of you may be familiar with. Only the recording I carried out in Burma lingers in my memory. There was a charm about the people, the country, and its music that made a strong appeal to me. These are the words of Fred Gaisberg's account of the initial field trip to Asia on behalf of the Gramophone Company. Now, that work, as well as Michael Keener's work to elaborate on the first and subsequent recordings captured in India, I reference here only to remind you of that work, since it has illuminated in some small ways the path we have traveled with the recordings made in Burma. I'll also call attention to an article in a 1996 issue of the Journal of Asian Music authored by Tan Tse Bing, which further elaborates on the recording industry from the same period in Malaya. Such accounts are helpful in as much as they parallel efforts to record the music of Burma and trace the larger trajectories of the recording enterprise at the time, such as a similar process in which the initial recordings conducted by specialists coming in and traveling into the area led to training among local engineers that then developed production companies with strong ties to Gramophone and the Graphone Company. And then finally led to, and of course those were still manufacturing records in Calcutta and later in Dum Dum. And then finally to local production, actually in Burma. The decline of recordings as an effect of the Depression, and then later on the Second World War, after which, of course, film tended to push 78 recordings into a secondary position. And finally, perhaps most importantly to me in my own research, is the role that these recordings and the recording process played in the change in transmission of musical knowledge. And I'll reference again here the shift from the importance of the courts up north down to the city, Rangoon. And this is something that's discussed at great length in the literature on Burmese music. For our purposes here, I'll reference Po Sein, who Fred Geisberg actually expressly mentions in his own account of travels to Burma. He's a relatively unknown performer in Rangoon with no real ties to the court, who became a superstar on account of having been the first person to be recorded by Geisberg, and then was recorded over and over again as the decades passed. It's sort of an interesting shift in repertoire in the canon, but then also a shift in importance to dramatic performing arts and the music contained therein. Right. No. The book was published in 1946, his account. We're talking about the very first years of the 20th century.
Sorry.
Okay, so there are also, besides the similarities with Malaya and the recording process in India, there are a lot of differences that are intrinsic to Burma. Ongoing resistance to British rule, coupled with the difficulties faced in ethnicity dynamics within the country, meant that Burma only realized brief periods of stability and progress, though these were certainly meaningful. With terrific potential being realized in both education and agriculture, Burma was poised to be a successful modern nation. But returning to divergences in British protectorates, not least of the differences are the directions each of these countries, meaning India, Malaysia, Singapore, and Burma, took as modern nation states after the war. Burma, after a brief and tumultuous experiment with parliamentary democracy, spiraled downward through a long period of isolation, eventually autocratic rule, in which its status as one of the most prosperous countries in Southeast Asia, with rice exports being at the center of its economy, diminished into what we now know of the country today, largely isolated and largely poor. So that's establishing a little bit of a background in order to give an idea of what the state of affairs are within the country as we began this project. And it's meaningful in that archives, libraries, collections within the country are largely isolated. The university's central library certainly has a collection. There are a couple of other library collections at universities within the country that are significant, but they are largely closed, not only to outsiders like me, but to much of the population within the country. So there's not a lot of training, not a lot of oversight, and honestly not a lot of knowledge about what's left of the collections that exist in the country. So we turn to personal collections as the source for our project and survey of what was really out there. And that in and of itself also presented certain challenges. The first of which is that largely in personal homes, the quality of care was actually pretty poor. We saw many situations in which people had the 78s merely shelved on their bookcases without any sort of protection whatsoever, and were largely exposed to the elements, easily dropped and cracked, a lot of damage among these collections. In fact, one of our collectors showed up. We set up a project site in a hotel, in an office, and showed up for the first day of transfers with 178s that were tied through with a piece of metal wire. And he had picked them up out of the cab and dropped them down on the curb and told the attendant at the hotel to be very careful at what he had just taken, with what he had just taken out of the car and placed onto the road. We experienced a lot of these kinds of experiences. There was some problems in that there's still a lot of suspicion within the country as to the intentions of anyone who is foreign, and a lot of xenophobia that's bred. And so we were at one point accused of being spies by one of the collectors who was actually formerly a member of the military intelligence organization. So that also put a little bit of a kink in our project, in as much as suddenly no one wanted to talk to us. But we were able to clear that up. We most certainly, I think we just presented the obvious fact that what spies would be interested in recordings from the 1920s. I'm going to run through a couple of extra slides. Part and parcel with the difficulty of finding the recordings, and there is also a difficulty in finding information about recordings, and especially when it comes to the recording labels that popped up locally later in the 1920s, 1930s or so. Not only newspapers being a source, a potential source, we've found that advertising for records are fairly minimal and largely focused on the larger companies. Case in point, on the far right there, you can at least see the familiar image of the puppy staring down the horn. These were advertising tends to be limited to very popular recordings, most of which were dramatic plays of Poe's Seine again. This is an advertisement from 1911. Same sort of thing, a great deal of information about two particular recordings. This goes on through the newspaper holdings that we've been able to access. A lot of Parlophone advertisements pop up in the 1920s, that sort of thing, but we really haven't been able to piece together historical information on locally produced recordings that we've come across. Okay, and so a quick glimpse of the usual suspects. And I can start to give you metrics for the project. At this point, the project has, we've had our hands on 2,500 unique entries that we've fully documented. We're actually up to 3,700 or so that have crossed up across our hands. HMV figures largely in this. At this point, of the 2,500 that I'm telling you about today, 430 of those are unique sides. I'm talking about sides. 356 of those are Columbia. And interestingly, only about 8 each of Parlophone and Odeon. So those are the major labels that pop up. After that, we've actually been very surprised to find 75 so far unique labels. And I'm going to give you a little bit of information about the largest ones. Of course, British Burma and British Burma Film was, of course, connected to HMV. The Twin, A1 also share a lot of matrix numbers, and it's therefore assumed that that a lot of the recording engineers were the same, and the production, of course, is still with these labels was still in Calcutta. I'll point out a couple more that aren't actually here. Oh, I'm sorry. And the second to the last interesting interestingly, is the Bamatamidol. Around about the time of 1960 to 1963 or so, that the military is finally taking over for the very last time until present day, we saw a huge growth in recordings of course, spoken recordings coming from the Bamatamidol. The Damodol is the military. At this point, we've found close to about 100 sides of their recordings. A couple of shots of those labels of A1 and Twin as well. And then finally, here's a list, a partial list of the 75 remaining. And what we've seen out of all of this is that there are a couple even here. These are in smaller numbers. The previous slide were recordings that we find roughly in the 50 to 100 side range. These are all below 30 or so. And what we've seen happen with these, with most of these labels, are these are the labels that popped up after, and most of them were produced in Burma. Pop up a good in the 1920s and 1930s, once a handful of people were really well trained. Although it's not entirely apparent here, from what you know, what we see is, starting in the middle column, Ang Chat Thaye, Ang Siti, Ang Thabai, Ang Win Win. These are all names of particular performers, and it seems that they took their own popularity in having, recorded previously on either HMV and Columbia and turned them into their own personal recording labels. And so we find with most of those performers, they were producing their own recordings. All right, and I think that I'll end with a couple more labels for those of you who are into seeing those. I want to say here, I didn't hand anything out, but if anyone has any interest whatsoever of seeing photos of labels and matrix numbers and catalog numbers, I'm happy to share all of that with you. And we'll continue to work on the project. So I'll continue to update it. And then finally, one of the recordings.
ชิดอนอยู่หน่วยเยอยู่สุขามงนาลังมาลูราญ่อย่อมเมต้องอยู่นี่ยวนเวลังกวยมองนี้ตะคอกตะแกอยอกลาแกเมตะคอกตะคาอยอกลาแกเมชิดอนอยู่หน่วยเย
Okay, sorry to cut it off, but I've been given a signal. I'm going to end with the same call that I ended with 4 years ago. If any of you happen to have Burmese recordings kicking around in your collections for which you haven't been able to establish records, I'm all too happy to share my expertise in Romanizing or helping with records, and just in order to be able to see these things. Thank you all very much.
Left a big pile of water.